From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, airstrikes on Gaza recommence after a fragile truce falls apart, with Israel promising even greater force against Hamas.
Egypt has put forward a ceasefire proposal that Israel has accepted. And what we would like to see now is Hamas and the other groups who are firing rockets from Palestinian-held territories to also accept the terms of that ceasefire.
Also today, we're in Moscow, where 20 people have been killed after a subway train derails in rush hour. And out with the old, in with the new. UK Prime Minister David Cameron announces his controversial cabinet reshuffle.
The right-wing Eurosceptics will like the fact that there's a tougher voice on Europe in the Foreign Office. People in the middle ground will like the fact that there are more women and there are fewer, basically, posh blokes running the country.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Attempts to negotiate a truce between Israel and Hamas appear to have failed after the armed wing of Hamas described an Egyptian ceasefire proposal as a surrender. An Israeli was reportedly killed by rocket fire from the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, the country's first fatality since the conflict began last week. Earlier in the day, the Israeli Security Cabinet voted to accept the Egyptian proposal, but with hopes for a ceasefire seemingly shattered at the White House, spokesman Josh Earnest put the blame firmly on Hamas.
The firing of rockets from Gaza at innocent civilians in Israel is completely unacceptable. And Israel and Israel's leaders are certainly entitled to take the kinds of actions that are necessary to keep their citizens safe.
At least 20 people were killed and 150 injured after a train on the Moscow Underground was derailed from its tracks during the morning rush hour. More than 1,000 people were evacuated from the scene. FSN's Jake Rashbass reports from our Moscow bureau.
Officials are exploring all possible explanations for the crash, but have ruled out a terror attack after a large team of experts found no typical signs of such an attack in their investigation. A spokesman for Russia's investigative committee says it is likely that the accident was caused by some sort of technological fault. Meanwhile, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin has declared the day after this tragedy to be a day of mourning throughout the city and has said that those responsible for this incident will be not only fired but severely prosecuted. Jake Rashbass, Moscow.
There's more from Jake on Twitter. You can follow him at Jake Rashbass. 89 people were killed in a suicide bomb attack on a market in Afghanistan. The blast took place in Paktika province in the east of the country. No group has claimed responsibility. Jean-Claude Juncker has been formally voted in as the European Union's next Commission president. The former Prime Minister of Luxembourg was approved for the EU's top job by members of the European Parliament voting in Strasbourg. His election came despite ongoing objections from Eurosceptics, who believe Mr. Juncker will ignore calls for reforms in Brussels. Germany's triumphant World Cup team has been given a hero's welcome by fans in Berlin. Players displayed the World Cup trophy at the city's famed Brandenburg Gate. Paul Hayward, soccer correspondent for Britain's Daily Telegraph newspaper, says Germany could dominate world soccer for several years to come.
Spain are no longer the rulers of world football. Germany most certainly are. We've become the first European side to win a World Cup on Latin American turf. But if these players can stay hungry, then Germany can go on and dominate for the next 6 to 10 years.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says the organization has a moral duty to help fight Haiti's cholera epidemic. Over 700,000 people have been infected with cholera since 2010, and evidence suggests it was UN peacekeepers who introduced it to the country. From FSN's bureau at the United Nations in New York, William Denzelow reports.
Acknowledging that the epidemic has caused much anger and fear, Ban Ki-moon says he will try and raise $2.2 billion to fight the spread of cholera in Haiti. The UN is facing three lawsuits in connection with the cholera outbreak, but has claimed legal immunity and has rejected claims for compensation. Over 8,500 people have died in the epidemic, with one lawyer for the victims calling the Secretary-General's visit an insult when he refuses to take responsibility for the deaths. William Denslow, New York.
British Prime Minister David Cameron has completed a major cabinet reshuffle, which has been much wider than anticipated. A dozen older male ministers have been ousted, with younger female Conservative members taking up new top jobs. The biggest name change was Foreign Secretary William Hague, who is stepping down at next year's general election. From FSN's London Bureau, Natalie Powell has more.
After 26 years as a Member of Parliament, William Hague says he's decided to step down at the next general election and moves to a lower profile role as Commons Leader. Philip Hammond, the UK Defence Secretary, is taking over as Foreign Secretary, while Minister without Portfolio Ken Clark has resigned from the Cabinet after 40 years. The reshuffle is being called the cull of the men in suits, making way for younger female politicians to take up top positions, with Nicky Morgan moving into the role of Education Secretary and 38-year-old Liz Truss becoming Environment Secretary. Natalie Powell, London.
And that is the latest feature story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Egypt has put forward a ceasefire proposal that Israel has accepted. And what we would like to see now is Hamas and the other groups who are firing rockets from Palestinian-held territories to also accept the terms of that ceasefire.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest today after a ceasefire plan put forward by Egypt fell apart. Israel's prime minister accused Hamas militants of ignoring the truce and continuing rocket attacks on Israel. Mr. Netanyahu said his military would respond to Hamas with even greater force. Over 190 people have been killed in Gaza and hundreds more injured, with reports that Israel has suffered its first fatality since the conflict began 8 days ago. Josh Mitnick is in Tel Aviv for the Wall Street Journal.
Shortly before 9 o'clock, the Israeli government announced that the cabinet had decided to accept an Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire, and that it was supposed to start taking effect at 9 o'clock in the morning and include a 12-hour sort of de-escalation period, followed by a complete cessation of hostilities by the evening, and then followed by follow-up diplomatic talks in Cairo with both sides, with Egypt. However, those hopes quickly collapsed. Within an hour, there were Palestinian rockets from Gaza into Israel, and within several hours later, the Israeli army saying that they had restrained themselves long enough, and that there had been several dozen Palestinian rockets into Israel. Renewed its fire into Gaza. I should mention one thing is that despite the Egyptian ceasefire proposal that Israel accepted, it's unclear to the degree to which Hamas was on board with this. Its military wing in the morning before the Israeli cabinet accepted it said that it considered the Egyptian ceasefire proposal to be a joke, and that it hadn't been in the loop on the diplomacy.
And also, Josh, some reports of the first Israeli fatality.
Right. We're still I'm still trying to get details on that. But from what I know, it was the IDF said it was a rocket attack, but I'm seeing reports that it was a mortar attack on an Israeli crossing point at the Gaza border. This is the Erez crossing. It's on the northern end of the Gaza strip, and it's a VIP crossing for humanitarian cases and journalists and diplomats. And it seems that a civilian had fatal wounds from that attack. And this is the first. This is the first fatality in a week of hundreds of rocket attacks on Israel.
And while Prime Minister Netanyahu has said that there will be even greater force from the Israeli military following the continued rocket fire from Hamas, he also sacked his deputy defense minister.
That's right. The prime minister has come under criticism from members, hardline members in his coalition, who would like to who are or who are frustrated or unhappy with the fact that that the prime minister, to begin with, they're unhappy with the fact that he hesitated before this started. He gave Hamas, let's say, several days to try to de-escalate and return to a calm before embarking on the operation. And this morning they were up happy that the government accepted the ceasefire, and they want and one of the deputy defense minister, his name is Danny Danone, he is part of a group of people in the government that want to see Israel order a ground offensive, invade Gaza, and to oust the Hamas. They're trying to reflect public sentiment that's fed up with three wars in 5 years with Hamas, and frustrated that these ceasefires keep on collapsing. The prime minister, however, seems to be functioning or operating with his ear to the ground on what the international community is prepared to accept, and also what he perceives as Israel's interests. And I think there are a large number of Israelis who are opposed to the idea of Israel going in and ousting Hamas and reoccupying the entire Gaza Strip, as the foreign minister of Israel called a press conference and made that call. So it's an indication of the political complications that the prime minister faces in accepting the ceasefire and then having a collapse in his face.
And Josh, the Obama administration today said it hoped Hamas would agree to the ceasefire proposal, and that there was a sense that it would be positive if Egypt could revive a ceasefire plan. But beyond that, is there a sense where you are that America's role is constructive enough, is having enough influence on the situation?
I think there's a sense that the U.S. is limited in its ability to put the pieces back together. The sense is that the U.S. is trying to work through its regional allies with ties to Hamas, but the U.S. itself considers Hamas a terror organization and doesn't have any dialogue with Hamas. So it has to work behind the scenes and encourage Egypt, who has a new military-backed government that also views Hamas as a terrorist organization. So they also have a very strained dialogue with Hamas, and it's also unclear if Egypt, which served as the mediator and the ceasefire broker when this last happened in 2012, it's unclear if Egypt is able to bring a deal home this time.
Josh Mitznick in Tel Aviv for The Wall Street Journal. This is FSN Reports. At least 20 people have been killed and 150 injured after a train on the Moscow metro was derailed from its tracks during morning rush hour today. More than 1,000 people were evacuated from the scene. Anya Ardayeva is our correspondent in the Russian capital.
Russian officials say at least 19 people died and 127 were hospitalized following a deadly crash in the Moscow subway. Most of the victims are from the very first carriage of the train, which suffered the biggest damage as the three derailed cars rammed into one another. At least 50 people are said to be in a grave condition, and many of them were airlifted to the hospitals from the scene.
Anya, some of the footage of the train has already emerged, and the mangled carriages, they're located underground between stations, so that can't be easy for emergency services. Can you tell us about the scale of this rescue operation and where it currently stands?
The rescue operation lasted 7 hours and is now over, and it was certainly complicated by the fact that the tunnel where the incident took place is located between two metro stations, with one of them, Park Pobeda, being the deepest metro station in Moscow. That station is 275 feet or 83 meters below street level, and emergency workers reportedly evacuated some 1,100 people from the train located deep underground. Some 100 police officers, 7 helicopters, helicopters and dozens of ambulances took part in that very complicated rescue operation.
And Anya, have Russian authorities said what might have caused the incident?
The city's mayor, Sergei Sobyanin, said it was too early to say what exactly caused the derailment of the cars, but he said it was most likely caused by the train stopping abruptly. Now, what caused the train to stop is to be investigated, he said, but officials already ruled out terrorism as a possible cause for this crash. Sobyanin promised a thorough investigation of the crash and said that those responsible will lose their jobs and that there will be criminal cases opened against them. Now, it is important to say that there have been numerous warnings about the Moscow metro system needing urgent repairs. Critics of the Moscow government here have been warning for years against putting too much effort in expanding the existing metro system as opposed to investing in its urgent maintenance.
Anya Ardaeva in Moscow. Now, UK Prime Minister David Cameron has been reshuffling the Conservative Party members of his governing cabinet. There were some surprises, including the UK's Foreign Minister, William Hague, taking the opportunity to step down from his post. FSN's Catherine Drew met with political analyst Paul Osborne outside the Houses of Parliament to discuss the possible strategy behind the changes.
It's a lot more significant than I think many of us were expecting. I think we thought what David Cameron was going to do was a sort of minor shuffle of the pack, move a few people around, certainly promote a few more women. We weren't expecting to see very senior members of the government, people who've been in those roles in some cases since the first day this coalition was formed 4 years ago, being moved onto new jobs, some cases being moved to jobs where you'll barely see them again in public. It's a much more significant change than we expected.
We've seen the promotion of several women, including three with major portfolios who will sit in the cabinet. Why is this happening now?
This has been one of the criticisms that David Cameron's had since the beginning of this coalition. The phrase he hears all the time is pale, male and stale. This idea that his cabinet is made up of men of a very similar background. They've been to private schools, they've been to the best universities. The criticism of that is maybe they don't understand the lives of ordinary people, and the most glaring omission in David Cameron's cabinet is women. Now, he would say when he came into office in 2010, there were hardly any women in the Conservative parliamentary party with experience of being in government. He did promote a lot of women to junior ministerial roles then. They've been able to move forward now into some cabinet roles. He's basically doubled the number of women in the cabinet now. Still a relatively small number, 6 out of more than 20 cabinet positions. But it does change the public perception of the Conservative Party. It means there'll be a lot more women appearing in front of cameras, talking about the Tories before the election.
And how important are women ministers to capture the female vote?
It's very important for getting a certain section of the electorate who did vote Conservative in 2010 to come back to the party in 2015. The Tories picked up a lot of votes, people who in the past had supported Tony Blair and voted for the Labour Party. The problem is, some of them have moved away, partly because of 4 years of austerity measures, big government spending cuts. Some of them don't feel as well off as they did 4 years ago. And a lot of them just don't think the Conservative Party that they see on television every day really represents the country they live in, the people they are. So having more women, for example, one of the new cabinet ministers is a working mother who runs marathons in her spare time. That's a very different type of Conservative to Ian Duncan Smith or Michael Gove, who are people who've been in the political game for donkey's years. It's a very significant way to reach out to people who voted Conservative in the past, were maybe thinking about not voting for them in 2015. But there's another thing going on as well. By moving women into these frontline positions, at the same time, it sort of covers up for the fact that what David Cameron has done is shifted his government a little bit to the right. He's made some appointments that are also designed to appeal to those people who voted for the UK Independence Party earlier this year. He really needs to get them back by next May.
The new team are also more Eurosceptic. Is this a response to the growing popularity of the anti-Europe UKIP party in local elections?
David Cameron knows that one of the biggest risks to him getting re-elected next year is UKIP. They're taking votes that really ought to be Conservative votes. They're picking up votes in the places where the Conservatives need to be winning elections. He has to appeal to those people. He has to find a way to get them to support the Conservatives next time. And one way of doing this is to just go after the same appeals, the same issues that UKIP have gone after, and the big one is the European Union. David Cameron's already said that if the Conservatives win the next election, he'll have an in-out referendum on whether Britain should stay in the European Union in 2017, and before that, he'll renegotiate the terms of Britain's membership. He's now appointed Philip Hammond to be Foreign Secretary. Mr. Hammond is much more Eurosceptic than William Hague. He has talked in the past about how if there was a referendum now, he would vote to leave the EU. He's a hardline Eurosceptic, and now he'll be playing a prominent role in negotiating Britain's future in the EU. The message that's designed to send to UKIP voters is, you can get the change you want with the Conservatives, you don't need to vote for UKIP.
Now, we're just 10 months from a general election. What does this reshuffle say about how David Cameron will take on the other parties?
It is extraordinary that after more than 4 years of a government that's had to introduce massive spending cuts, that we still honestly couldn't tell you what's going to happen in the general election next year. It genuinely is all to play for. The Conservatives could win an outright majority, Labour could win an outright majority, we could have another hung parliament, and the Liberal Democrats could once again end up as the kingmakers. It's wide open in a way that I don't think many people expected. This is David Cameron trying to tie up the two sets of voters that he needs to get alongside the core Conservative voters. The right-wing Eurosceptics will like the fact that there's a tougher voice on Europe in the Foreign Office. People in the middle ground will like the fact that there are more women and there are fewer, basically, posh blokes running the country.
Paul Osborne, political analyst, talking to FSN's Catherine Drew. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, are you a morning person? If you are, the chances are that you make at least one radio station somewhere very happy. In the world of radio, station executives generally consider the morning hours to be their golden moment to capture audiences. The morning hosts of radio programs can offer command greater salaries, more resources, and larger audiences than their evening companions. Well, now there is a radio station where it's always morning. Global Breakfast Radio has launched online. Its output, a constant stream of morning broadcasts from wherever it happens to be morning at the current moment. It's the brainchild of Seb Emina and Daniel Jones, and you'll hear from them in a moment, talking to Robert Pound of London-based Monocle 24 Radio. But first, a sample of the output of Global Breakfast Radio.
You've been listening to the 11:45 edition of The Big Stories on Observer Radio, News Talk 911.
Well, that's a good-looking horse Chester's riding, man.
He's thinking of buying it, Doc.
Buying it? Buying it. With what?
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Whatever their Lord intended guidance for them.
Suggests as long, you're talking about swim lessons, maybe you could get the Red Cross or somebody down here and bring people in to get lifeguard lessons.
Chip Gard from the National Weather Service expects the following damage as a result of the storm. The possibility of tin roofing becoming airborne now.
The whole thing started with a conversation that Daniel and I had when I was writing my book, The Breakfast Bible, which is all about breakfast, the meal of breakfast. And it just occurred to me, this idea that it's always breakfast time somewhere in the world. And I was chatting to Daniel, and he's a sort of sound and systems artist, does lots of technology and audio and radio and that kind of thing. And we had this notion that you could actually, in theory, listen to breakfast radio all day, every day. And there's a kind of lovely idea surrounding that. And the sunrise, I think, the idea that the sun is always rising somewhere. And there's something kind of poetic about that image.
So talk us through a couple of the ones that our listeners, as international as they are, might not have heard. You mentioned French Polynesia, various different places. We were talking about small radio stations in the Bahamas and things. But tell us some of your favourite ones. When it's, say, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon here in the UK and you guys are like, right, we've got to get on to somewhere in the flyover states of the United States, for example.
Well, at 4 p.m. in the afternoon, I think it's around breakfast time in Alaska, I would guess, in the West Coast. And there's a wonderful radio station broadcasting from a small promontory, I think, is that right? Called Unalaska in Alaska that plays a lot of weird and wonderful North American music, and there's a whole lot of college rock stations as well on the West Coast,
yeah,
that we've been incorporating, as well as the more kind of esoteric far out side of things. There's a great station called SF Sound broadcasting from San Francisco that's kind of an art radio station, and really one of the things that we're trying to do is pick out stuff that is quite characteristic of those places, as well as trying to create a kind of global portrait, really, of all of the esoteric and all of the kind of mundane and everyday that exist across the world.
I mean, it's not always cheery. It's not always, you know, hey, pop listeners, you know, have a great day.
Hey, kids,
today.
Thanks for tuning in.
Exactly, all that stuff. And sometimes it's surprising how opposed to maybe the British idea of breakfast radio these stations can get. I mean, SF Sound, the art stations, they make no concession to breakfast at all. It'd be like clicks and shuffles and discordant saxes, all that kind of thing. There's no concept of breakfast there or morning. It doesn't matter. I think there's an Antiguan station where the morning slot is for reading out the obituaries from the community. So again, a very different idea of breakfast radio.
We regret to announce the death of Leonard Rouse, Carmen Hendrickson, Florence Jarvis, Ellen Nibbs, and Claudia Garnett.
There is that strange idea we have, that idea maybe that breakfast radio has to be all cheapy chirpy and kind of happy chappy kind of stuff. When you're curating and you're putting together your list of stations through the day, that you have to inject a bit of levity here and you can have some sort of serious college rocks action there. Do you want it to, what sort of rhythm and ebb and flow do you want the sound of your station to have?
I think the levity kind of comes naturally. I mean, as we said, there is a seam running through that. And in part of the process of listening, we're trying to keep our own listening eclectic as we kind of navigate through all of these different countries. And one of the things to be said about the station as well is that though we've curated the kind of palette of stations that it draws from, the actual selection of those is done by an automated system that will kind of move every 15 minutes now from station to station. And so the rhythm is a lot more chance-based than anything that we could select. But you kind of, you know, you pick up these patterns running through it as you run through Africa, across the Pacific and so forth. You kind of get these natural geographical rhythms more than anything that we've intentionally programmed into it.
Every listener in a different time zone gets a totally different schedule in the day. So for us, we have a European morning, an African morning, and then we have an American afternoon, and then a sort of Pacific Australian evening when we're listening to that. But if you're in Japan, you get a whole different schedule.
Yeah.
You get an Asian morning and a European afternoon.
Seb Amina and Daniel Jones talking there to Robert Pound of Monocle 24. Their new radio station, Global Breakfast Radio, is online right now. A place where, as they put it, the sun is always rising. You can find it online at globalbreakfastradio.com. And you can hear more of their chat with Robert Pound on another online radio station, Monocle 24. At monocle.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.